Right. Hey, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianek on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 coming at you live if you're listening today. And today is August 27th, I think, something like that, in the year 2016, that we know. And broadcasting you, as I say, live from our new digs in the heart of Idaho Springs, in the center of the universe, Clear Creek County. And it is a fantastically beautiful day out there. So I'm hoping all, which I'm sure you are, is just absolutely enjoying our blessings, the beautiful blue sky. It's just nice and, relatively cool, maybe 70-ish or something that like that. And bunches of people here in town. So it's awesome. Everyone's enjoying the mountain scene. And so this is the rabbit hole. And, coming at you, as I said, here from our new dig. So I want to do a shout out and thank you to Mary Jane Lovely for supplying this for us, allowing us to come in here. It's just beautiful. So when you get an opportunity, we're in the Majestic building. Come by and take a look. And, it's going to be a lot of fun here. So we want to remind you that this show and all of our talk shows are recorded and will be uploaded to the website. And this one in particular will be also uploaded to my website, and because I am sponsoring this show, Jerry Fabianek, and you can get more about me and my book, Sisyphus Wins, on my website, jerryfabianek.com. And, so we want to thank all of our sponsors, by the way, before I go on, because without those sponsors, community radio like this, nonprofit, all volunteer, would not be possible, and allow us to bring such great shows to you here. And on my show today, we're going to do back-to-back, a double feature for a Saturday afternoon here of Writer's Talk, and two completely different genres talking, authors about their work. So I'm really excited about that. And in the studio right now with me is Lori Mar Wassman. Lori, did I say that correctly?
Yes, you did.
All right. And, I just want to tell everybody that Lori Mar Wassman grew up on a cattle ranch in Castle Rock, Colorado. She received her BA in English and French and her MA in English from the University of Denver. She has taught at DU, Metro State University, and most recently at the Arapaho Community College. She also manages her own editing business and publishing imprint at Lost Ranch Books. So you can find that at lostranchbooks.com. Her short fiction has been published in college literary journals, and her articles on Colorado history have been published in the Old West and the True West. I imagine those are magazine periodicals?
Yes, they are.
Wonderful. And she has two children. And lives with her husband, Bill, who's here, and hopefully not making you nervous. So, just tip that up there. So, Lori, welcome.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
All right. How was the drive up?
It was a bit congested this morning. And lots of semis, a little bit scary.
And but you got here early, and you enjoyed the town. How was that?
We did. We went to the Mountain Prime restaurant and had a very nice meal. And Then we've been looking at some of the shops and enjoying the variety of boutiques in Idaho Springs.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, and I haven't tried yet, and it's been highly recommended, that Mountain Prime. I understand they got some really high-quality food there.
Yes, they do. Yes.
All right. Yep. So we're giving a shout out. So hopefully Mountain Prime, you need to come on, by the way, as a sponsor here. So if you hear this, just FYI, we're giving you free shout outs here. And, but it is, I understand, it's great stuff. So, Lori, you quite a background, as I do, in education. Okay. You've been teaching primarily at the college level then?
Yes.
Okay. And, what you're writing, because your writing is generally in the historical American history genre here, and we're going to get to several of your works there. Why that? What since your background is more in the English area, but you focus on American history, is it a special interest? How did you kind of move in that direction?
Well, Jerry, I was raised in a Scottish family, and it seemed that the culture in the Scottish world is very much invested in history and in storytelling. And my family embraced that, and we lived through stories. We lived through our family's history. My grandmother wrote history. She wrote a column for the Douglas County News Press at the time, and she also wrote a book on Douglas County history. But my mother's family, which was also Scottish, brought a love of knowledge, a love of land, a love of being involved in mm-hmm. life and being involved in understanding the history of where we came from. And my mother is the best editor I have ever had.
Oh, wonderful.
She helped me with my writing quite a bit.
Okay. And I would, you know, in that tradition, the Scottish tradition, there seems, if I recall, because, and that's one of the few places that on earth I really need to get one to go. In fact, my favorite Shakespearean play to teach was Macbeth. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I got to get there. And, but it seems like there's this, like, relationship between the people and the land. And does that come through, you know, how does that play out, that, you know, for your work and where you come from there?
Well, it plays out largely in my life. I still live on a little bit of acreage and am able to enjoy that. And also, in each one of my books, I have some sort of connection to the land. Mm-hmm. In My Heart Lies Here, which is the Ludlow Massacre, Christian has a connection to the coal canyons near Trinidad, where she lives. In Clean Cut, it's set near Yellowstone National Park. And so those folks have a lot of connection with the land and a lot of space around them, a tremendous amount of space around them. They're very isolated. In To Do Justice, my young woman who goes to France with a relief society also comes from a ranch in Colorado.
Okay. And you know, you mentioned To Do Justice. Now, that's part of a trilogy that you are in the process of writing?
It is. Yes, it is. It's the most recent book that I've published, but it is the first book of a trilogy. The titles, actually, of the trilogy, the books come from Micah 6:8. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Mm-hmm. And so I chose To Do Justice, To Love Kindness, and To Walk Humbly as my titles for the three books.
Okay.
Because we have questions of justice, we have questions of kindness, and we have questions of how to live our lives in a world where so much is cruel and so much seems evil, and how do we live our lives in a spiritual way.
And this, they're set back in during the World War I era.
Yes.
So like about a century ago.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what, talk about that a little bit there. Now, because I think, was it on your website, I saw some pictures of your grandfather and, you know, I guess, what they call them, the doughboys or something going over. What, talk about that a little bit. That's an intriguing period.
Okay. Well, of course, it was not a popular war until the Lusitania was sunk. And at that point, then America decided that it needed to leave its isolationist position, which President Wilson had encouraged and had actually won his second election by promising to keep us out of the European war. But eventually America came around and realized that it needed to take part in that war. As for my grandfather, he only arrived in the United States from Edinburgh in 1910. Mm. And so he was relatively a newcomer to the United States. And then he enlisted again in 1917. And he and my uncle Henry Halgate Storm were both in really the first wave of soldiers to be sent to France. And they really didn't receive a whole lot of training. Most of their training was done in France. Mm-hmm. They were engineers. They went over to build. And it wasn't until late in the war that they actually picked up arms and went to war. It mm-hmm. was in May, June, during the great American offensives of that spring.
And that was a relative to other wars that are in our nation's history. It was relatively a short one, if I recall. Mm-hmm. It was like we got in, and then like a year and a half later, the armistice was signed. Was that, am I correct on that?
You're right, yes. Actually, we barely got into that war. We started to form our own army immediately after war was declared in April 1917. But Pershing refused to allow the American soldiers simply to be integrated into the English and the French.
And Pershing is what?
General Pershing, General John.
He was like the top general in our
Blackjack
army.
Pershing.
Blackjack, there you go.
He would not allow the American soldiers to be used as cannon fodder by the British or the French. Mm-hmm. And so he insisted upon keeping his troops underneath American command. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it took America a long time to actually get their soldiers on the ground. There were only a few by the beginning of 1918, but eventually there were 2 million soldiers over in France in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And I think that because Pershing insisted upon that, it saved a number of American lives. It probably mm-hmm. kept us from losing far more men than we did.
Yeah, and it seems that when you talked about the sinking of the Lusitania, what kind of came to mind for me, Lori, was the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
And like a wake-up call. Okay,
yes.
And we can kind of close our eyes and hold our, you know, cover our ears and so forth there, because we have this concept in our tradition of the Fortress of America. We're protected on two sides by the ocean. And, you know, and particularly today with this global economy and, you know, we talk about international terrorism and certainly technology, instantaneous, you know. I mean, if you got friends in Europe or Asia, like a piece of cake to send them an email, you know, you stay in instant communication. So in a way, it becomes like a false sense of security there. And that seems to have been what was the mindset then, and then it kind of got us into, would you say, like our first foray into international, I mean, direct, heavily involvement with international affairs.
It really shaped the America that we know today. For one thing, it was that reaching out beyond our coastline and getting involved in Europe, getting involved with oil production and in the Middle East that would come from World War One. Also, it was the beginning of big government in America because President Wilson nationalized the railroads, the steel industry, and Smith & Wesson, interestingly enough, and kept them under government control. There was also a large movement to equalize, and that meant that instead of competing, for example, the oil producers were cooperating. They set a certain price, and they were all selling their oil at that price. Mm-hmm. And so some of the subsidies and some of the tax breaks for large corporations also sort of had their birth in World War I in 1917.
So a lot of where we are right now, we can trace our roots. It seems to be a real shift then in the trajectory of American history in this time period, 100 years ago then.
Yes, I think we can. It's very interesting. Also, mass production came into being. Of course, Henry Ford had started it. Mm-hmm. But mass production in clothing, mass production in goods, household goods, in anything that you would pick up and use on a daily basis. Of course, some of that's good because of the regulations. There wasn't as much perhaps individuality or cheating or anything like that. But also, it made us more democratic, but it also made us less individualistic.
Yeah, and interesting point also, because when I think about that and put it in social context, because you were talking about, for example, maybe the economy and, you know, with the big interest and so forth there. Mm-hmm. But World War One, if you look at the dress of women in the 1910s, very Victorian, mm-hmm. covered long dresses. I mean, the hands, I mean, no bare arms, anything, you know, and certainly the ruffled collar coming up. And then you think of the flappers, and that was only like a decade later.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so was this kind of, you know, do you think this war sort of like pulled that out, this, you know, got us in a different place, you know, how we think about and how we act as a people?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that the austerity that was sort of forced upon Americans during the war, and of course Prohibition started at the same time, more or less, that was forced upon Americans, and that led to the 1920s when everybody said, I don't want to think about the war. I don't want to think about all these 6 million men who died. I don't want to think about all of that. I want to be happy. I want to live my life. I want to be young and beautiful. And I think we see that in the 1920s. It was a time of rebellion. Mm-hmm. It was a time also of opening up of women's rights and the roles that were expected of women. Mm-hmm. And were allowed to women, actually.
Yeah, and you know, you think because I think it was yesterday or day before, was the 96th anniversary of the 20th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, and that was a huge tectonic shift for American male culture. You know, today it's like, you know, what's the deal? And here we have Hillary Clinton running for president.
Right.
We got women actively, I mean, maybe carrying arms, participating literally in mm-hmm. battle.
Yes.
And I think it started then, didn't it, in World War I with the inclusion of women in the military, active military?
There was some inclusion of the women in the active military, but they were basically assigned desk jobs. They were support roles, okay. which, of course, they're still doing in large part today.
Sure.
It's only recently that the combat question has been resolved to a certain extent. But there were women Marines, there were Navy yeomen, and there were also typists and other secretarial type support that went with the Army as mm-hmm. well. And of course the nurses, the Army yeah. nurses were sent overseas in large numbers.
Yeah. And it wouldn't be another two decades, a quarter century in World War II with the Women's Army Corps and the Air Corps, mm-hmm. I think it was the Women's Air, the WAC.
Right.
And
yeah.
so there was literal, I mean, participation, again, not in active combat, but certainly in a very strong participative and supportive role
right.
in there.
And in that instance, the roles were widened so that women were flying transport planes and doing that sort of thing. They mm-hmm. weren't just secretarial in World War II.
Right. And we're starting to really see an evolution, in that regard. Margaret Sanger. She
yes.
comes to mind now. Who was she and what was that all about? That's a real interesting, she's jumped in mind here. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah,
Margaret Sanger, of course, is still controversial today because she was the de facto founder of Planned Parenthood. And so at the time, Margaret Sanger was removed from the mainstream women's movement. The suffragettes that we think of, Susan B. Anthony and those who were after the vote, they saw the vote as being a huge step forward. What Margaret Sanger wanted then was access to birth control for all mm-hmm. women.
Mm-hmm.
And she was arrested. She did time in prison for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was against the law to send any sort of information about birth control through the mail. So there was always that possibility of mail fraud. She would try to publish in magazines, and they'd be shut down because they couldn't be sent through the mail. It would mm-hmm. be against the law. And there was a movement called the National Woman's Party, which in Denver was headed by Mary Reed. And if you know that name, she was married to the oilman Werner Z. Reed. And she gave a lot of money to the University of Denver. There's actually a building named the Mary Reed Building on campus.
Okay.
She was the leader here in Denver, and that group of women was not happy to just have the vote. They wanted access to birth control.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an interesting sort of undercurrent that we don't hear much about
right.
when we learn about this in history classes.
Right, and the evolution of women's rights overall, starting back with, I have a piece going into the Clear Creek Current next week, so you might want to take a look at that. And I do a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, and it's about Hillary Clinton running for president, and I talk about women through history, and I start all the way back with Eve. And then I talk about Medusa and Pandora. And, of course, they're mythological concepts and so forth. And then Hester Prynne, mm-hmm. who, in the Scarlet Letter. But then get into the real people, in the Revolutionary War, Molly Pitcher, Abigail Adams, and then right on through Seneca Falls. And this stuff doesn't just fall out of the sky. It comes about because of steady progression, people
right.
staying in it. And it seems that's what was pretty active at that time then.
It was. It was. The National Women's Party would chain themselves to the Capitol building and that sort of thing. They were very militant. And they were basically disowned by the suffragettes.
Oh, wow. You know, it'd be, in today's lingo, you might say something like, you rock, girl.
Yes, I think.
Oh, that'd be great. Now, there was a you know, World War I was a difficult time for men, too, because of, you know, and it even goes back, you know, with conscription, you know, the draft, and making men go off to war. And it became really institutionalized, World War II. And then, of course, in 1973, it's technically abolished. Mm-hmm. And there's debate, you know, and back and forth on it. But that was a real difficult time. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Conscription was, of course, used in the Civil War. But at the time, you could buy your way out of it. When it came about in World War I, that was not allowed. If you were called up by the draft board, it was still a local draft board, but all the same, if you were called up, then you went to war. Mm-hmm. And there were certain deferments. There was a 16-page questionnaire that was given to each young man of a certain age. They started at 21 to 30, I believe, or 35. And a questionnaire was given to them. It was 16 pages. It asked about whether they could support themselves or their family could support itself while they were gone. Mm-hmm. And then they were chosen if indeed it looked as if the family could take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And there was some backlash, mm-hmm. a little bit of unwillingness to go. And one of the people who refused to go from the Denver area was by the name of Ben Salmon. And he refused to go based on his religious faith, and that was the Catholic faith. And he would not go because it would violate the Sixth Amendment, which is thou shalt not kill. And because the Catholic Church supported the war and deemed it a just war, and really, really did encourage its followers to support the war, Ben Salmon could not receive a deferment. He could not find his way out. And so instead what happened was he was finally arrested and court-martialed and sentenced first to death, but then he was sentenced to 25 years at Fort Leavenworth.
Wow.
And he spent 2 or 3 years there. I think President Wilson finally pardoned him in 1920,
okay.
Along with all the other conscientious objectors. But they were imprisoned as the worst kind of criminals, and they were mistreated. There was a group in North Dakota called the Hutterites, and they were German, of German heritage, so already unpopular at the mm-hmm. time. And then they refused to wear clothing that they had not sewn themselves. That was one of the tenets of their religion. And they were sent to Alcatraz. And I guess there's a level below Alcatraz that the tourists don't see that is simply little cells that are carved into the rock mm-hmm. with bars on the front. And the Hutterites were imprisoned there, and they were stripped of their clothing. They were sprayed with cold water. They were given bread and water to eat, no sunshine. The treatment was just absolutely abominable.
Like waterboarding.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It comes to mind, wow, that's it, you know, and this is America, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing this to, quote, our own people.
Right.
But that moral dilemma, you know, and of course, I come from the Vietnam generation. And, you know, it's like, what do you do if you oppose this war? You go to Canada, you go to jail, you know, whatever. And if I knew this was coming up, I would have brought a copy of my song, John Fogerty, a song about Favorite Son.
You know? Yes.
I'm no
yeah,
senator's son there. But one other point I wanted to ask you, Lori, before we move on, because I think you might want to do a reading, too, from the work there. And that is... this idea of Americanizing the country. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the first time it really comes up. And today, we see this very powerfully in our political discourse, if you want to call it that. And it's probably using the term very loosely out there, you know, making America great again. And everyone knows who I'm talking about. But this notion, this theme goes back, you know, 100 years ago easily.
Right. The Americanized, there was a committee that was set up by the governor of Colorado that wanted to Americanize the Germans who lived in Colorado. At the time, there was a population in Colorado of about 800,000, mm-hmm. and about 56,000 of those were direct German descendants, including a number of Russian Germans who were living on the eastern plains, Fort Morgan, Greeley, that area. And if the Austrian heritage was also taken into account, nearly 10% of Colorado's population was of Germanic heritage. Mm-hmm. And so it was a huge number, 80,000 people. And the governor and several businessmen, George Norlin from the University of Colorado, he would later become the president of the University of Colorado. At the time, he was only a professor. He was appointed to head a committee, and it was called America First Society. And their goal was to Americanize Colorado by teaching English, by teaching the various steps of the government, civics classes, all of that, and by bringing these people to American values, which is something we're still hearing today. Yeah. And instead, what happened was it led to widespread discrimination against anyone sure. who had a German name or seemed to be of German heritage. Terrible things were done. There was tar and feathering happened in a couple of places. I think it was in Grand Junction that the superintendent of school was stripped of his shirt and a yellow stripe was painted down his back before he was run out of town. The Denver Post published a list of all the women who had German surnames in the town, in the city of Denver, and opened them up to all sorts of violence and discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so unfortunately, perhaps it was a good idea, perhaps it was well meant in the beginning, but it actually led to this large-scale violence and this large-scale attack against people of German heritage. And also, the Ku Klux Klan came into being just a mm-hmm. few years later and actually managed to get control of Colorado's government in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And so I believe that this is sort of the seed. We see the seed from which the plant grows.
Yeah, you can almost, not every detail, but certainly if you simply substitute heritage Mexican for German today, or Hispanic or whatever. Mm-hmm. We're seeing history almost repeat itself. Maybe not that horrifically, but certainly that. And that just talks about our dark side as a people. And I like to bring that up when we're talking here, because everybody has a shadow. Everybody has a dark side, the stuff we don't want people to know about. And so we ignore, we put it away. It's just, mm-hmm. Basic psychological tenet. Well, as a people, all peoples have that too. And so we always pride ourselves, America, we defend liberty and freedom. Yeah. And you know what? It's true. We do those things. But there is that sinister dark side to our past and present that makes us uncomfortable when we really talk. But, we have to talk about it. That's my point of view.
We do. And as a history teacher, that no one is ever without blame. There is always some sort of action that could have been done better, or another action might have been taken. Something could have been changed in our historical past.
Do you have a little piece you would like to read for us from that
Yes, this is from To Do Justice. One of my characters is an American ambulance driver, a la Ernest Hemingway. He's from Yale and has volunteered his time to go to France. And so this is just a couple of paragraphs from To Do Justice. He climbed from the Packard. The ground shook beneath him as bombs fell along the trenches. Even from this distance, dirt and a claw swirled in the air. Along the front, the phosphorus bursts kept the sky ablaze with sickly white light. At a pool of mud, a gang of French soldiers had gathered around others who stood knee-deep in the ooze. Using links of board or long rods of metal that they had salvaged from the ruin, the men plied the mud, trying to dislodge something. Paul stepped forward. All that was visible in the mud was a man's back. The rest of his body had sunk into the mess. Un, deux, trois. The soldiers leaned on the makeshift levers and tried to lift the man upward. Nothing happened, even after a second attempt. A soldier near Paul calmly remarked, "Too many have stepped on him. He is stuck forever." Evidently, the officer in charge agreed, for the order was given to assemble and march. As Paul watched the column tramped through the mud toward the front, he stood transfixed, his eyes on the spot where the man had been lost, his stomach and heart knotted, a voice within him still crying, "My God, you cannot leave him. You cannot refuse to rescue him."
Wow. That's great writing.
Thank you.
You really help bring it alive. You know, it's historical fiction, so the characters are, of course, created,
yes. But
set in a very real time, and so much of that we can identify with because we're experiencing the same thing and the human experience. I mentioned, for example, the conscientious objector in World War I. Well, I was a Vietnam era guy, So I know all about that. Those of it did. It's an amazing, pretty powerful piece there.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And you can get that if people want it. And we'll come back to this, though, but you have a website they can order from or Amazon.
Yes, I have a website, and there are links that you can buy it through. And also Amazon CreateSpace.
Wonderful. I just want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on the air here in Idaho Springs. We're in the rabbit hole. Writer's Talk, right now visiting with Lori Marr Wasman, and we're talking about her works. And there's a couple more I'd like to get into. And so let's move forward with that. And you mentioned you have one that's more current, set up in Yellowstone. What's the name of that one?
It's called Clean Cut, and I call it a romance of the Western heart. Because it simply explores what it's like to live in a small town and also what happens when we're isolated and what happens when we are connected with large swaths of land. And for Clean Cut, I took a lot of stories that came out of my background. I've always lived in small towns, although at this point in time, none of them are small towns. Parker, Castle Rock, Elizabeth, Kiowa, they're growing very rapidly and have sort of lost that small town feeling. But I wanted to explore that, and I wanted to explore it in the 1980s, before technology became connected us with the entire world. Mm-hmm. And so I set the book in 1986, and I started it with the death of the town legend, the town hero. He's a hunter. He's a fisherman. He has escaped from the narrow confines of the town and from working in the sawmill, which is the only industry, by becoming a fishing guide, a hunting guide, by living life the way that all of the town feels that it should be able to live life. And so I started with his death, and then I end it with the Yellowstone fire of 1988, which actually changed that landscape and changed the world to a certain extent up in Wyoming.
Yeah, and it reminds me, when we first started talking today, and I brought up the point, you know, about your Scottish heritage and how certain peoples, and probably every people in a way, but, you know, some in particular are more powerful, shaped by their environment, their culture, their outlook, and to look at, you know, you're taking small town, big expanse of, say, eastern Colorado, pretty isolated compared to being in a major city, Denver, or even a really super mega city like New York City,
right. And
how that shapes people's mores, their values, their thinking.
Mm-hmm. And it could go either way. For some people, the land allows them to live with a vision that's much broader, that's much more holistic, perhaps, than many of us have. And for others, being isolated in those small towns, being without opportunity, without economic advancement, means that they become very narrow, they become very unlovable and unloving as well. And also they can become cruel, and they can also become violent.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, like you say, it goes both ways, because then it can also, you know, that the idea of the barn raising, because you couldn't build your own barn. And so your neighbors who live miles and miles away would all come around. There was that sense of community, too,
yes. You
know, in there. But there was also this fear of the outsider, you know, that comes in as opposed to city, urban areas.
Right. And I found that just a couple of things to touch upon. I actually have not a barn raising, but they build a log house together in my book, in Clean Cut.
Oh, wow, okay.
And then also I have a number of people who have come in from outside and have come into this very insular community, and this community that excludes others. I have an environmentalist from California who sits in front of the mill and protests the mill day after day after day. And I also have the mill sold to a larger corporation, which of course was happening in the 1980s. Those small family-owned companies were being swallowed up by huge multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. And so the manager who comes in to take over the town's sawmill is an outsider. Mm-hmm. And has no understanding of the land, has no understanding of the people, drives a BMW in a town full of pickup trucks, and never fits in, never makes his way into the town. He's always an outsider, and at the end, he runs. He literally runs away from the town.
Instead of becoming involved in. And I tell you, I think it's a story that would really resonate with small community such as here in Clear Creek, Idaho Springs, because technically we're classified as rural, and we are, because we're not part of the metro. Yet we're on the way to Vail and Breckenridge and so forth, and Denver's only 30 to 40 minutes away. And, you know, technology certainly connects, but we're also isolated. So there is this the juxtaposition of the two that's in the people here. You know, we're kind of our little town, yet we're part of the larger one, too. I think it's a timeless theme, it seems.
I think so. Although, as I said, technology is, of course, bringing us so much closer that I don't know that we feel that isolation quite so much anymore.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, and do you have you want to share something from Clean Cut?
I do. I have just a quick passage. This is from the main character's viewpoint. Her name is Sherry. It's written in first person, and it was her husband who died at the very beginning, and now his illegitimate daughter has shown up, and she is trying to process this. She takes a walk in the woods. Deep in the trees is a sudden jarring clearing. It's just dirt, everything scorched away for a good 20 or so feet in each direction. In the middle of the clearing lies a small steaming pool no bigger than a bathtub. The pool's water is dark green. Its rim is trimmed in a lace of ice where the ebb and flow have undercut the snow, then receded. In the years I've lived here, I've seen the ice both pocked and pitted by the water and sculpted so delicately that it looks like the finest spun glass. I've seen it glow emerald in the sun or turn murky in the winter gloom. I kneel to watch the steaming water caress the ice. Why is it all such a struggle? Why isn't it simple, clean cut, easy? And why in the hell is Erica Wiggle in our lives? I look at the water again, and Lex's words come back to me. This pool is alive with hundreds of microbes, hundreds of lives that flourish and multiply without witness, that can never be judged a waste or sorrow. Lives that will never arrive somewhere alone, that will never feel unsuited to the task or drenched in misgivings. Exquisite, I think. And then I whisper it, exquisite.
Wow, that's beautiful. It strikes me as a teacher of English, of literature, and the beauty of the words, first of all, it's just a magic. You're so descriptive. The pool and, you know, the pitted and the emerald in the sun, but the dark murky in the, you know, in the winter. So we get that contrast there. But that allusion to the pool with life and society in the world, that's a pretty powerful metaphor.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I'll be excited to read that one myself. So, it's like, this is one of the great things about doing this show now. I keep coming up with all kinds of great stuff. Like I said, I might not ordinarily have picked up, and looked at. And then just by having conversations and you read a little bit of selection, I'm like, man, this seems like a really powerful work. So I'll definitely get in there, because that does resonate for me, because I used to live down in the Denver area, and I've been up in the mountains here for, a couple of decades.
Right.
And so I have that, perspective on what it was like to live in the big town, out in the burbs, and then up here in the mountains, and how we're different, here. And I definitely prefer this here. You know, it's
yes.
my own little thing there. But we have one other work, too, I want to really get into a bit.
Okay.
And it, you know, it's the Ludlow Massacre, and so it's going to take us right back to where we started our conversation
right.
100 years ago. Talk about that a bit.
Well, the Ludlow Massacre was one of the most shameful incidents in U.S. and Colorado history. But unfortunately, it's not as well known as it should be. And I wrote My Heart Lies Here so that people can pick this up and read about it. In 1913, the United Mine Workers of America organized, through great difficulties, the miners of John D. Rockefeller's Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, which some of us know. There was the huge steel plant in Pueblo, which ran for many years. And the mines were connected with that. And the strikers went out against the company and went out on strike. A huge tent colony was erected on the plains at the very end of what was called Berwind Canyon, where most of the coal came from. And in this tent colony were about 1,500 strikers to begin with. They were very multicultural, Greek, Italian, mostly Eastern European. And very few of them were well-versed in either English or in American customs. But here they were on this prairie in the winter of 1913, 1914. It was one of the coldest and snowiest winters on record. And other things went wrong. The UMWA did not count on the strike lasting as long as it did. And so they ran out of money and therefore out of food. They ran out of heating fuels. And then also, there was a lot of violence that was precipitated on both sides. The miners were not innocent, especially the Greeks who were in Ludlow, but neither was the company. And so the Colorado National Guard came in to keep peace in the area, and in so doing escalated the violence. And in April, on the Greek Easter, the Greek Orthodox Easter, which was April 20th, the Colorado National Guard, which it had been rumored that it would wipe out Ludlow at some point. Indeed, it set up overnight, and on Monday morning, the strikers woke up to be surrounded by machine guns, and the shooting started. I don't know who started it. That's still up for debate, whether it was the people of Ludlow or whether it was the Colorado National Guard. And eventually, the tent colony was burned. And the strikers had dug pits below their tents, both for storage and for protection from gunfire. And two women and several children, 11 children, were down in those pits. And they stayed throughout the fire, and they suffocated to death. So the Ludlow Massacre actually refers to those two women and the 11 children, although between the two sides, over 100 people were killed in that five-month span.
Okay. And, you know, it just, you know, hearing this description, and I'm familiar with the experience that I've written on it, you know, so the history of the experience. And it just struck me how, I mentioned before about the shadow in our society, that when we think of Colorado, we think of Rocky Mountain High and beautiful mountains and snow and skiing and all that other, and it is. It's very much there, and that's what many of us move here, live here, and, you know, to whether you're up here in the mountains, you love that, or out in the plains, and, you know, that wide open expanse. But there is this dark side, and when you were talking about Ludlow, what comes to mind for me is the Sand Creek Massacre, which took place, 40 years before, maybe?
In the 1860s, yes.
Yeah, so it would have been close to 50 years before, too. But innocent people being mowed down. Mm-hmm. And our government was actively participating in this.
Yes. And in the Ludlow Massacre, of course, it was Elias Ammons was the governor. And he was the one who sent the Colorado National Guard to the region. But he never declared martial law. So there was always confusion. Were the strikers under martial law? Were they not under martial law? Where was the law? And there was always confusion. Also, because the state of Colorado ran out of money to pay the Colorado National Guard, the responsibility for the Colorado National Guard was turned over to the oil companies, or the coal companies. And they were allowed to bring in their mine guards and enlist them in the Colorado National Guard. So by the time that Ludlow burned, many of the Colorado National Guard members were actually mine guards who had been hired to come in and quote, keep peace, which they never did in the coal canyons in the first place.
Right. And then we have this ethnic conflict going on at that time. We talked earlier about how in World War One, which is the same time, Germans were the primary victim, if you will, identified, but we were at war with Germany. Okay, so while it's not an ethical approval thing, but it kind of makes sense in that way. But what we have here are other Europeans, darker skin, a little bit different lingo, a whole lot different lingo, language than compared to the more refined English, French, whatever. Okay, I'm Slavic heritage. You know, I call myself goulash. You know, my dad was Croatian primarily. My mother was Slovak, a little bit of Polish, a little bit of Italian. You know, it's like all mixed together, which is all good, you know, that sort of thing. And then think of the Greeks and, and my mind jumps all over the place. And I'm thinking Zorba the Greek and that great story by Nicola. I can never say it again. But this other type of culture, you said, for example, in there that of the groups, the Greeks were probably not as, my words here, not yours, willing to cooperate or just roll over anything. In other words, they stood and fought for their rights.
Yes, the Greeks and the Italians. The Italians were hugely involved in this. And there are many people in the Trinidad area who today will say, my grandfather carried a gun at Ludlow. And that's a point of pride at this point. The Italians were very much behind the Union. The Greeks were a bit more rogue. They were a bit more maverick. And were not as easily managed by the United Mine Workers of America, except for the fact that they had an extraordinary leader in a man by the name of Louis Tikas, who was a young Greek. He was only 33, but he had actually been to college in Greece. When he came to America, of course, language barriers and other prejudices did not allow him to take a job that he was educated for, and so he ended up in the mines as well. Okay. And he led the Greeks and was really largely responsible for keeping peace for as long as it lasted in Ludlow.
Wow.
He could keep them under control.
Yeah, and my first thought when you said about the Greeks being rogue, and I thought, that's still true today. Angela Merkel, and Angela, I should say, it's a hard G in German. She found that out a few years ago.
Yes, she did. Yes.
It's like, no, and, you know, it's the birthplace of democracy. And guess what? Democracy gets messy, and it's not as disciplined and controlled as an authoritarian society. And the Greeks, by nature, you know, I would think, of course, we don't want to stereotype, but they tend to be a little bit. And that's why I love Greece. I've been there, and I want to go back, spend a lot more time there. You know, quite a history with that. But anyway, yeah, and I mean, just that time, it was so, I mean, the foment that was stirring in America. You know, there was the war in Europe, but we weren't involved yet, but certainly had taken, you know, starting in, well, it was building up there, and certainly the assassination of the Archduke of Austria happened at the end of June in 1914.
Right.
Now, this happens right before.
Right.
There's a lot of foment about the labor unions, the labor's rights, women's rights. I think of that character, Joe Hill. I don't know if you've done any study on him out in Utah.
Right.
And if you know anything, can you speak on him a little bit?
I was actually thinking of Lafayette, so perhaps you know more about him than...
Yeah, Joe Hill, he was a Swedish labor organizer. And quite a history, and came over, and he got caught up, and he was framed for murder and basically was assassinated by the state of Utah. It was right in that time period. And to his credit, and Woodrow Wilson has his pluses and minuses, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as a historical figure. But he tried to intervene and save Joe Hill, and the state of Utah refused to do it, and they shot him, you know, firing squad. Yeah. But he was completely framed for the murder that was there, and the evidence is there. But, I mean, it was just to study this. That must have been really exciting for you to do all this research.
It was a lot of fun to do the research. And just going back to Joe Hill being framed, John Lawson was the name of the president of District 15 of the United Mine Workers of America. And at the end, after everything, after the dust settled, after the Ludlow massacre, he was charged for a murder that had been committed while he was in Denver. Mm-hmm. On that day, he had proof that he was in Denver. There were eyewitnesses, and yet he was charged for murder, and he did 2 years for that before he was finally released. Mm-hmm. At the end of the Ludlow massacre, also, there were 400 and some counts brought against the various miners for crimes done throughout that 5-month span. However, there were 67 counts brought against members of the Colorado National Guard. They were all dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it sounds like the Creek Massacre.
Certainly does, yes.
Oh, yeah. My God.
But in researching this, I was able to take advantage of a couple of things. I went with the Colorado Endowment for the Humanities on a 1-week excursion down to Trinidad and to Berwyn Canyon and to Ludlow. And there were two wonderful instructors. One was Dean Seda of the University of Denver. They were doing an archaeological dig there. And it was just so wonderful. It was a program that was designed for teachers in order to take this information back to their classrooms mm-hmm. and teach it. Mm-hmm. And so it was wonderfully creative.
Nice. And do you have a piece you would like to read from?
I do.
That history? I would love to hear it.
Okay, this is just after they've come to the tents on the plain in Ludlow. For a while, a brief while, we were free, just as the Union had promised. Free from the steep canyon walls we roamed at will. Free from work the men collected near the meeting tent, or at the baseball diamond, or the steel exercise bars. They juggled or did tricks with lariats, or tested their skills on a unicycle that someone had bought in Trinidad. They laughed and smoked and drank from flasks readily shared, sitting with square shoulders and backs that didn't ache from bending low in the mines. Women waded down the clotheslines with brightly colored shirts and union suits, or herded children across the prairie to school in the community tent. They haggled with the peddlers, flirted with the fair-haired photographer, and took from sealed crates the treasures of heritage, fans of ivory and silk that had belonged to a Croatian grandmother, crucifixes of silver, struck of silver, hand-cut Battenberg lace, and the furs of the last European wolves. They sang and talked and believed for a moment that they, too, could be free. At least 20 times a day, someone hummed "The Union Forever." We all joined in then, whether British, American, Italian, or Slav.
Wow. You bring people right there, and it's very human. You know, just, picturing the brightly colored shirts on the line and the guys sitting there in their chairs, not hunched over in the mine, but feeling strong and erect and full of hope.
Yes, definitely full of hope at this point.
At this point.
Yes.
And to be disappointed, obviously, in a great way. Magnificent work, Lori.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, if people want to get these, again, we talked to her, but talk about how people might be able to get this, these works.
Okay, you can visit my website at lostranchbooks.com. Lost Ranch Books is all one word. And I have a buying option there where I will actually send a signed copy. Or you can go to Amazon.com, of course, or Create Space.
Okay, and get them there. And highly recommended. Oh, this is fantastic. So I'm looking forward to, you know, getting myself and reading and, you know, and just enjoying it. So thank you so much for coming. I want to remind everyone that, of course, this show is recorded, and we'll have it up on the website probably by Monday. It will be repeated next week on Monday and Thursday, about the same time, I believe. And I will also post it on my website, jerryfabianic.com. And by the way, I'm sponsoring this show. So thanks, Lori, once again for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. And congratulations. You are to be applauded for your work, not only creating this, but the tremendous research that came in to make it real. That's great historical fiction.
Thank you.
All right. Now, we're going to take a little bit of a music interlude here and be back in about 10 minutes or something of that nature. But, in that vein, I just happened to pull up my Johnny Cash and Ira Hayes. There, I don't know if you ever heard the song, The Ballad of Ira Hayes, in World War II, and he was a Native American, and he helped break the code for the Japanese, or you shouldn't say it. No, okay. Let me rephrase that. That was a little different. He established it because the Japanese were not able to figure out the Navajo language. Mm-hmm. They were able to communicate using that. And so he was a hero and saved countless lives, participated, but a very, very tragic ending, speaking about the dark side of American history. So, all right, we'll be back in a little bit here, and here we go.